Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Spooky Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 48. Crunch sucks. Let's talk about why.
I am no longer Spooky Michael Footer because I am not doing the entire episode like that.
Give you $10 if you do.
I think I'll be hoarse by the end of that.
I think you will be too.
All right.
And then how are we supposed to do Ready Player Mom After Dark?
It's true. Where we are in fact playing spooky games. But for now, let's talk about spooky lawsuits.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Woo!
Okay. Not really a spooky lawsuit. But 2K is being sued by a tattoo artist. Now, if this sounds familiar...
I feel like this does sound familiar. This actually predates both of us in the industry.
It does. And this goes all the way back to 2009. Tattoo artist Catherine Alexander found out that the WWE was planning on selling cosplay arm sleeves for wrestler Randy Orton. They were using his tattoos so people could put these sleeves on and pretend to be Randy Orton.
I don't know what a Randy Orton is, but that sounds really fascinating.
He is a WWE superstar.
That's literally all I know.
Yes. And the sleeves, of course, were going to feature her tattoo art because...
Oh, but they weren't going to compensate her.
Well, right. So she approached the WWE and said, hey, that's my art. And the WWE laughed at her.
Those jerks.
So this has been going on for over a decade now. And Hollywood Reporter actually covered this story. And this is directly from their write-up. Quote, an Illinois federal judge handed her partial summary judgment by determining that WWE and Take-Two Interactive Software, the publisher of the WWE 2K series of video games, had indeed copied her work. Now, of course, we're not just talking about cosplay sleeves at this point. We're talking about a digital representation of a tattoo artist's work.
Yes.
So, this is also continuing from the THR piece. Now the question for a jury, and this will go to a jury, is whether that rises to copyright infringement. The judge denies the defendant's own motion for summary judgment by deciding that certain questions are trialable ones. Mm-hmm. These include whether Alexander impliedly licensed Orton to disseminate and display the 6 tattoos she inked for him.
So there is a difference between, let's say, because I have a beautiful tattoo that Danielle and I, you know, got, like, designed by a tattoo artist, and we share it. And if someone were to put my license into a video game, that would be infringing. In my opinion, that would be infringing. But people just looking at my tattoo in photos, if I'm the one that took them,
right,
or let's say they're taken at a convention, like, that seems to me like, where is that where the line is, Mike?
I think in this case, yeah, we're talking about the commercial purpose. So what,
right.
So what's happening is, so this is an interesting one. So this actually has already been to court. Or a related case has been to court.
What was the related case?
Take-Two, again.
Okay.
And NBA 2K.
Uh-huh.
So there were tattoo artists that said, hey, those basketball players that have our art on them.
Yes.
Have been in your games.
And you're replicating their tattoos.
Yep, and that includes LeBron James, Kenyon Martin, and Eric Bledsoe. And Take-Two won decisively. So this is going to be very interesting. The fact that... So there's a reason why this is going to court.
Interesting.
Even though the NBA 2K case has already been settled. So in the case for NBA 2K, that was tried in New York.
Okay.
And the judge in that case felt that the tattoos were displayed so small that they weren't akin to what is actually on the athletes. And that even if they were, the license was implied and the case for fair use was strong. I actually take objection with the first of those. And I feel like this is a case of digital technology being so much faster than the law.
Yeah.
It's too small. Like these athletes.
They're still recognized. Well, I think that where the judge was coming from on that one, if I had to guess, was it was about, oh, well, you can't replicate it yourself. Like you can't like trace it and draw it and get it tattooed on your own body based on the video game.
Maybe. I mean, if it's the appearance was too small, then that's not someone like as soon as you have a photo mode, right? In one of these games and a lot of games are launching
well,
with photo modes now.
Well, when was this taken to court?
This was a couple of years ago. In fact, I think I want to say this happened within the last 5 years.
Okay. Well, then, so, yeah, then photo mode is definitely, then that, yeah, that's a little bit of a foolish thing
but, to say. But what we're really focusing on here, to me, is the second two pieces, that there was an implied license that if you're a tattoo artist and you put your, and you put your work on a celebrity, then you can't, like, by
it's
saying...
It's not the same thing as tattooing just, like, your regular average human being.
Right. And, you know, it would be unreasonable for you to say that you, the tattoo artist, then control how that celebrity gets to appear in a digital medium, for instance.
That's really interesting. I hadn't considered that.
And the other piece of this is the fair use. Now, the issue here
but
is
Michael,
that,
we've discussed fair use so much. Should we go into it again?
I would need to make sure that I had all the notes.
but what I'm trying to say is we're not going into it again.
No, but what I will say is this. Fair use is an affirmative defense. It says, yes, we are infringing on someone else's copyright, but we have the right, but we are able to do that based on the law, based on all of these conditions. We're only using a very small part of the,
right,
of the work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So the reason why the judge in this case, over the WWE thing is taking it, is saying that it needs to be heard in front of a jury is because the Seventh Circuit, which is a separate circuit than the court that tried the NBA 2K case, recognizes this defense. This is from the filing or from the order. Whether the Seventh Circuit recognizes this defense to copyright infringement claims is an open question. So it hasn't been settled in the Seventh Circuit yet.
Got it.
The defense has been successfully invoked to allow copying of a small and usually insignificant portion of the copyrighted works, not the wholesale copy of works in their entirety as occurred here. So again, this comes back to the fair use thing, as I just said, where one piece of the fair use conversation is how much of the work. For instance, in our show here, we take a couple of sentences from somebody's written work.
But we credit them.
And we credit them. But we're not taking the entire thing. We're not reading somebody's entire piece on our show.
Can you imagine how boring that would be?
There are people who do that, believe it or not. There are YouTubers who just read articles. In fact, I'm not getting into it. No beef. No beef on this show.
No beef. No boof.
No la boof.
No
la... Oh, Sarah.
No, we want boof. We want la boof.
Yes.
Sarah's great, but yes. No boof.
No boof. Additionally, in the court documents, quote, it is unclear whether Alexander, the artist, and Orton, the wrestler, discussed permissible forms of copying and distributing the tattoo works, or whether any implied license included sub-licensing rights such that Orton could give permission for others to copy Alexander's tattoo works. Writes Yandel. Thus, the evidence raises a trialable issue of fact as to the existence and scope of an implied license, and defendant's motion is denied as to this affirmative defense. So,
okay. So, can you break it down into the TLDR for that?
Sure. So, the question here is: this comes back to that question of if I'm a tattoo artist and I work on someone who is a celebrity. You know, am I implying that they can show their body in a digital medium or for other commercial purposes?
Yeah, that's really tough because it's not the same thing as like going onto the red carpet at, you know, the Grammys or the Oscars or anything like that when we had red carpets.
Well,
but
yeah, go on.
So like when I think about that, like when you're wearing a specific dress, when you're wearing, you know, you have your hair done by a specific stylist, like you're supposed to be showing yourself off. Mm-hmm. It's essentially advertising.
Yes.
And it's the same thing for the tattoo artists, is there are plenty of tattoo artists out there where if they do end up tattooing a celebrity, it ends up being a boon for their business because more people seek them out. They look at the tattoos and they're like, I love that style. I love this. Who's your artist? And so on and so forth. Same thing with hairstylists, same thing with clothing. It's just, to me, I think that where the sticky thing is that because this is in a video game and not just a photo or not just in, you know, a movie, I guess, because movies are different. They're not interactive.
Mm-hmm.
This is just like, it's, well, so brain boggling.
Additionally, it has to be reproduced.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're not just taking a photograph and scanning it. It's not a photograph of the art. It's the art has had to be physically reproduced on that digital representation of the wrestler.
Exactly.
In order to appear in the game.
Well, so, I wonder if that would extend to something like, have we seen that in toys?
Yeah, likenesses. Absolutely. Yeah. So generally likenesses, but that's, again, this is where the sublicensable thing comes
exactly.
in. Because if I'm a celebrity and I say I have the right to say, yeah, you can use my likeness for this toy or not, or for this game or not. But the question is then that sublicense, does the person say you have the right to use the tattoo that's on my arm?
Oh my God, this is such a fascinating conversation. We could talk about this all day.
Now, again, we've already seen how it came out when it was the NBA thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is going to be terribly different. What's interesting to me here is Alexander's no longer a tattoo artist. So what the filing says is a couple things. First of all, because Take-Two is admitting that they've copied the tattoos, they have to present an affirmative defense that meets the criteria of fair use. What's interesting here, they also say that it's de minimis, which means that
what does that mean?
It means that it is a minimal piece of the finished work. Now,
okay.
The problem with the de minimis argument, according to this, and this is where the jury piece comes in, is that the WWE and Take-Two also say that if the wrestlers weren't accurately represented, then it wouldn't be authentic because they want to portray an authentic. Here's from the filing. They also acknowledge that consumers expect there to be authenticity in the video games and that WWE would have rejected Orton's video game persona if it appeared without his tattoos or appeared with tattoos that were different than his actual tattoos. So, the tattoo artist, Alexander, presented an expert that says that authenticity drives sales and profits.
Which is true.
It is. Now, the other issue is because she's no longer a tattoo artist, the issue of damages. Now, if you're going to win a court case against someone for infringing on your work, there needs to be some kind of proof of damage done.
Right, but since Alexander's no longer a tattoo artist, it's not the same kind of thing as, like, who did your work?
Exactly.
And then like, getting more sales from that, getting more business from that. So what can she do instead?
Lost licensing fees. Because she went to them and said, you have to license this from me. Mm. And that's where we come back to, was there an implied license here?
Oh, it's all very cyclical.
It is. So I'm really interested to see where this goes and see how this plays out. Hollywood Reporter story, the link is in the show notes. Please go read the whole thing. They were kind enough to also put a scribed link embedded with the actual court filing if you're interested in that as well. And that's where we pulled a bunch of this stuff from. But that is that. We'll keep our eyeball on that. What else do we have?
All right. The next thing that we have to talk about is AT&T Unlocked Games.
Mm-hmm.
AT&T is running a competition for, quote, women-identifying developers, and it's called AT&T Unlocked Games. The telecom, media, whatever company.
Whatever AT&T whatever classifies itself as.
I don't even know anymore. Giant conglomerate.
There it is.
Is taking applications through October 26, and we put the link in the show notes. So six of these finalists will participate in a Twitch stream with prominent streamers, Ammunitions, and Binance. I'm not familiar with Binance, actually.
Hmm.
Where they will pitch their game to judges for a chance at $50,000 to fund development. Viewers will get to vote for a Gamer's Choice winner.
Yeah, so it sounds like there'll be a couple of different winners.
That's pretty interesting.
So the winner will also get, or winner or winners, will get a dedicated activation.
I got tripped up. I was like, I was reading this and I'm like, wait a second. Activation. Okay, so.
So they'll have some kind of presence.
They'll have some kind of presence, some kind of thing to do or whatever at DreamHack 2021.
Assuming that happens in person.
Assuming that happens and is in person, where said developer will be able to demonstrate and debut her work. She'll receive complimentary travel, VIP attendance to DreamHack, spending cash for her and a guest. This is the cool thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Mentorship and a lifetime membership to the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, mm-hmm. which we all know and love in a variety of different capacities for the work that they do for developers around the world, and potential placement into Steam, and that's not Valve Steam, but Steam as in science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics, Curators Connect program, the promotional and marketing support from AT&T, including a $3,000 credit to be used toward AT&T products like phones and tablets and all that stuff. All of that is really, really interesting.
Yep.
And I think that that will be, I mean, like, it's a tiny step forward, and $50,000 really isn't a lot of money to be giving a developer for a project.
It's not. But and there's a lot of non, there's stuff that doesn't have a monetary value attached to it that's really
exactly exciting. Like the mentorship, the life mm-hmm. and the lifetime membership to the IGDA is really amazing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're actually giving them quite a bit of money to use towards tech to run the business itself. It's not like the Galaxy Fund. It's not as though it's a prototype fund where you can just use it for whatever. Yep. But it is really cool. And I think that, you know, I'd like to see what comes of this. These competitions are not inherently bad. As long as no one is being exploited, I would be happy to see the games yep. that come out of this.
Absolutely. All right. Let's see.
Oh, goodness. Do we have another unforced error?
Yeah, it seems like Ubisoft is in the report, and I didn't even throw in the whole thing that popped up, I think it was yesterday, about, I think it was 20% of respondents to Ubisoft's internal survey.
I saw that.
Said that they had either witnessed or been subject to harassment or a toxic workplace environment.
Wow. 20%. That's almost one in four people.
One in five.
It is
one in five. It is almost one in four. One in four would be
25%. Okay, all right. I'm not good at math. I suck at math.
But this is not that. We're going to talk about Hyperscape for a little bit. So the Battle Royale games you tend to hear about right now, your good old Fortnite, your PUBG.
Your Fall Guys.
Your Fall Guys. Congrats, season
for
two.
For your Jelly Beans.
Yeah. And Apex.
Apex Legends.
And then Spellbreak, which is doing pretty well right now. But Hyperscape, which is Ubisoft's entry into the Battle Royale arena, has not done terribly well.
That's disappointing considering how stylish and gorgeous it looked. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it looked like it took a lot of different pages from a lot of different books out there and just kind of tried to make it its own. Mm-hmm. What happened?
So first, they are trying to right the ship with season two that is starting on October 6th, which is 2 days before Fall Guys season two. So good luck, Ubisoft. But they posted an extensive blog about what's going on, and I'll just read this passage from the blog post. 3 months ago, we released Hyperscape to the world. We're thrilled with the response as millions gave our take on Battle Royale a try, telling us specifically how much they love the movement and fast pace of the game. While July's launch and open beta on PC were successful, we're not able to achieve the high expectations we set for ourselves with our full release on console that followed in August. We also know we didn't fully meet the high expectations of our players, so we're taking action. We have more work to do to get there, but our team is fully committed to the challenge. Now, they identified a number of problems.
It does look like they identified a number of problems. What was one of the big ones?
So when we talk about games like this, especially competitive multiplayer games, we talk about skill ceiling and we talk about skill floor. Skill ceiling is how much room is there for you to get better at a game before you have fully mastered it. Skill floor is how easy is that to get into the game, pick up a controller, you know, sit down at your computer with a mouse and keyboard and feel mildly competent at the game and understand the basics and succeed enough that you want to try to get better. Because when your skill floor is too high, people bounce off very quickly. I'm not good at this game. I don't understand what just happened.
It
makes me frustrated.
It makes me feel stupid.
Yep.
Like there are a number, especially with multiplayer games, like single player games that are roguelites or roguelikes are a little bit different because you kind of expect that you're not going to be good at the game right out the gate. But it's not competitive. You're just playing a damn game. Yeah. And the only person that you're playing against is yourself.
Right. And I would say that if we're going to look at that genre, Hades, of course, as you know, because you played it yesterday on Ready Player Mom mm-hmm. for the very first time. I played it recently. That game's onboarding is exceptional. Dead Cells also has very good onboarding. I can't say that of every roguelite.
No.
But those two in particular, I think, have really good onboarding. Mm-hmm. I think Fortnite has very good onboarding. For a battle royale,
absolutely.
I think Spellbreak's onboarding is very absolutely good. Excellent. But Hyperscape was designed with a high skill ceiling, but the skill floor was currently too high. So that's what was happening. People were coming in, they were failing, which means they were dying quickly, or they just weren't having a good experience because they didn't understand the mechanics of it, and they were bouncing off.
So that meant that onboarding, so the things that you do in order to make sure that your players feel comfortable in your game, that you give them the tools to succeed to the best of your ability as a designer, you know, or a team of designers, you know, it just failed to get people acclimated.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. What were some of the other issues, Mike?
They said they don't have enough game modes. That Crown Rush mode, which is their marquee mode,
mm-hmm.
Is great, but there are other things that people want to do.
Could it potentially be that they want to go and win crowns in Fall Guys?
It could be. but there are other things they want to do in that game, and I feel like that ties in a lot with the fact that their season design, and Apex had this problem when it came out of the gate.
It did, yes.
Their season design didn't incentivize return play through mid and long-term goals. So what that means is your short-term goal when you log into a game like this is win the match.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your long-term goal typically is I want to max out my battle pass for the season.
Sure.
Your mid-term goal, and this is where Fortnite excels, is they add challenges every week, right?
Yes.
Oh, you need to go find all of these things, or you need to dance in these locations, or you need to shoot these letters. So it's stuff to do that not only enhances your short-term experience of playing a match, but serves to propel your long-term goal of reaching that max battle pass.
Absolutely.
So and it's this virtuous cycle of I get satisfaction from playing a game. I get satisfaction from completing these weekly midterm goals that also stick around for the season. So if you come in, late, you can go back and do all of those weekly things. It's harder, but, and then all of that feeds into the long-term. I progressed really far on my battle pass through skill.
Yeah, absolutely.
They, as part of this, they're also accelerating their crossplay timeline, which again is a big deal. Fortnite players, there are a lot of people who are like, I play with the same account on my PC and on mobile. And I sit down on the toilet and spooky toilet.
Oh my God.
And
don't take notes from Mike. There's no such thing as a spooky toilet unless it's, I don't know, orange. And even then that's spooky because it's ugly.
Yeah. So being able to carry to get those quick hits.
Ultimately what this comes down to is this is a game of engagement. And Hyperscape is not winning the game of engagement. Yep. Here. It's too bad. It's a very stylish game. It's got a lot of really interesting things that it's doing. But Apex had a big problem with that too. Yep. Where it's like, I don't know what I'm working toward. If I sit down and I play Fall Guys, I know what I'm working towards.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working towards looking adorable.
Yep, absolutely.
And winning those crowns so that I can buy more stuff in the store. That's what my long-term goals are. I don't care about no battle pass. I don't care about anything else. I just want the damn crown.
That's fair. That's totally fair.
More crowns is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Crowns are awesome. Crown Rush apparently needs some work. So it'll be interesting to see if they're able to right the ship on that.
I mean, this is Ubisoft that we're talking about. They if nothing else, they do tend to learn from their design mistakes when it comes to their games, even if they can't learn from their cultural mistakes within their studios.
Yeah, it just seems like Ubisoft does have that through line of not being willing to abandon something that isn't working right. It's time for quick hits!
I need a second. Okay. That was a lot. Anyway, moving on. So, first quick hit that we have here, EA Play is coming to console Game Pass on November 10th, which is the Xbox Series X and Extra Small launch day, and it's also coming to PC Game Pass.
Later. I apparently was writing that note and forgot to put later.
No. I knew it was coming later, but it's all good. The second thing that we got on the list is Sumo Digital, which has been making some serious waves for at least the last couple of years, has acquired its first U.S. studio. Mike, what's the U.S. studio?
Pipeworks, the developer of Prominence Poker, was founded in 1999, employs 134 people. They've worked on more than 100 games, including Terraria and some Madden games.
That's pretty cool.
The deal is valued at more than $100 million. Nintendo, speaking of millions of dollars... Nintendo has agreed to a $2 million settlement in the lawsuit over Switch hacking.
Interesting.
Engadget reports that Nintendo had filed the lawsuit against Uber Chips earlier this year in an Ohio court, claiming the site sold products from hacking group Team Executor that allowed customers to install and play pirated Switch games. A permanent injunction was also levied against Uber Chips, so they cannot sell circumvention devices ever again. A similar lawsuit is still pending in Seattle.
OWL Commissioner and Activision Esports CEO Pete
Vlastelica.
Wow. That's... Okay, cool. We figured it out. has stepped down from both roles. He'll be working in a new entrepreneurial role in the company. Here's a little snippet from the press release. Pete Vlastelica, CEO of Activision Blizzard Esports and commissioner of the Overwatch League, will transition from his role in ABE to focus on new entrepreneurial ventures on behalf of Activision Blizzard following the Overwatch League grand finals. He was instrumental in building the company's esports business and driving the industry forward, and we thank Pete for his contributions and impact on our business over the last 4 years. Before we move on with this, this does tend to lead me in the direction that Blizzard is abandoning esports.
With the exception of probably Call of Duty and an OWL, but we'll see.
I don't know, man. Like, Overwatch League didn't have the numbers this season.
Well, Overwatch, I think, has gotten a bit stale, and they announced Overwatch 2.
We need to, because the metas in Overwatch are stale, and the drama in Overwatch League is stale.
Well, and that's kind of the problem. It's like, okay, great, he's stepping down, but let's not pretend that Overwatch League is some paragon to look up to. I mean, there have been issues of players just doling out racism, homophobia,
misogyny.
It ain't great.
No, it's not great. And the problem is that esports is best experienced in person, and it's that kind of shared experience, like going to watch hockey or going to watch football or whatever in person is just, it's a very different experience than watching sports on television versus watching esports on Twitch.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening with the Overwatch League now that said commissioner has moved away. I'd be interested to know what the entrepreneurial role means. I feel like that's very similar to what Alan does within Blizzard.
Maybe.
Because Alan is like the in-business incubator guy.
Hmm.
So yeah. I don't know. I'm not super optimistic.
They also haven't announced his replacement yet.
Like I said, I'm not super optimistic about OWL and about esports at Activision Blizzard in general, because we've already seen what they're willing to do/not do when it comes to esports, especially at Blizzard.
Let's see, our last quick hit.
Oh, goodness.
Let's talk a little bit again about Sony and Spider-Man.
Ooh, is it about the puddles?
No. The puddles, you know what? In defense of puddles, a treatise by Michael Footer. That game looked great on PlayStation 4.
Yes.
I have zero complaints about the way that game looked on PS4. The screenshots and everything that we've seen in the PS5 version looks excellent. I have no...
It looks gorgeous.
Literally nothing to complain about the way that game looks.
And?
Now, so one of the things that came out this week is that they have reshot... I don't know if it's the mocap... Like, so it's still... Yuri Lowenthal.
Yes, as the voice actor.
And what they said was that the new actor is closer in bone structure to Yuri Lowenthal. The funny thing is, old Peter from the PS4 version looks kind of like Andrew Garfield.
A little bit.
And the new Peter from the remastered version?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Looks like Tom Holland.
Sure does.
So, that's really interesting.
So what are some of the implications, though? Because it feels like Sony is using tactics that you would use in this generation for next generation.
So, and I'm really glad that you said that. So let's talk about something. Reshoots on mocap are not inexpensive.
They are, in fact, very expensive.
Yes.
Because you need to pay a lot of people to do mocap. Yep. You have to pay the actors. You got to pay the director. You got to pay a bunch of people to be there to actually, like, do the technical work.
Our interview with Troy Baker. Troy talked about this stuff.
Yeah, he really dug into what goes into motion capture and what those scenes tend to look like. Mm-hmm. They are extremely involved.
Yes, and additionally, you know, Sony and Insomniac are both saying, like, look at all of these things that we did to this game. Look at these reflections. And again, the reflections do look better. The visuals do look better. I would also expect them to look better on a PlayStation 5, you know, with an upgrade. Now,
true.
What I'm having trouble parsing, because I am not a technical developer, is how much of that is spin.
Yes.
And how much of that is we invested a lot of money in this? How much of this was, you know, was a lot of elbow grease, and how much of this is, but look at all these things that we've done to it, with Microsoft also saying, hey, Gears 5 is going to be getting an Xbox Series X upgrade as well.
Sure.
and an Xbox Series S upgrade. Like,
it's extra going, small.
The extra small. It's going to look good, too. Forza is getting an upgrade, too. So how much of this is we need to justify our price increase versus, you know, the fact that we're charging for it versus, you know, the free upgrade path? Now, as you said, these are tactics
from this generation. And that those kinds of tactics would work in this generation where you're seeing games that are like, okay, well, I picked this game up when... I guess I picked this game up like 4 years ago. Yeah. Like, it's remastered
Last of Us to Last of Us Remastered.
Sure, absolutely.
That game has had significant improvements.
And it was well worth paying for again. I mean, you and I are in the midst of a playthrough of The Last of Us Remastered, and it is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I played it for the first time on PlayStation 3. Yep, so that upgrade is exceptional.
Yep, and that was end of the generation. So we're not even talking... Spider-Man was a couple years ago.
Yes. Now.
Last of Us was the last year of the PlayStation 3's life. It was right before, it was 2013.
It was, yes.
So then that came out, remastered, I think it was a year later.
Was it a year later?
Yeah. So we're
Might
talking,
have been two.
If that were this generation, we would be looking at that and going, okay, well, free upgrade.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the stuff that Microsoft is doing, and even some of the game, the third-party games, right? Are getting these upgrades.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about Cyberpunk a little bit later.
Yes, we will get to that.
But Cyberpunk Yakuza is getting a free upgrade.
Yeah.
There are a number of... Avengers is getting a free upgrade path. There are a number of third-party games that are...
Sure. So these kinds of tactics where it is not... where it is a fairly common thing to do within this generation, it is going to be abnormal to see it within the next generation. So it feels to me... like Sony is still a step behind what consumers are going to be expecting from next gen games.
Yes. And this is one of those things where in a vacuum, what Sony is doing is absolutely no different than what has happened at first and third party developers over and over again for the last couple of generations. From the PS2 to PS3 and from the Xbox to Xbox 360, you had the HD remastered versions, right?
Absolutely. And that was fine. And it was fair, but we are also looking at games being more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the midst of a global pandemic,
mm-hmm.
which means that even purchasing a console in this economy is challenging financially. It was difficult to find a console to begin with. And it's just all of these other things that are kind of tying into it. And then you pair that with how Xbox is being so inclusive with gaming for everyone. You look at Sony and you're like, okay, so you're being exclusive. Some people like that. Like, some people really do value that. And there's, like I said, no boof. It is what it is. Everybody likes their own thing. Everybody's values are different, and that's okay. But for me, if I'm making a purchasing decision, I am going to choose the console. Like, if I had to choose, we're not choosing, we're getting both. But if I had to choose, I would choose the console that most aligns with my values, and that's inclusion, not exclusion.
And, again, what Sony's doing is no different than what both first parties, and Nintendo especially, right?
Oh, Nintendo is so bad for this.
Right, if you look from the Wii U to the Switch and how many games they re-released at full price. The issue for Sony is not that they are doing it, but they're doing it in comparison to the way Microsoft is approaching things, which
and you can't exist in a vacuum.
You can't exist in a vacuum. The market has changed, but Sony seems to have stood still on this point. And those were quick hits.
And now it's a break. Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative. And along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz. All right, and we are back. We are back with some big stories. Our first story that we are going to talk about is, I think this is like part five of this saga.
Six?
Part
seven?
Six. I don't even know.
It's 2020.
Everything is
Trials are a flat circle.
Trials are a flat circle.
In fact, though...
That's what kind of what happened to Epic a little bit. Kind of turned into a flat circle.
Yeah. So just a quick update on Epic versus Apple. Two things happened. On Monday of this week... there was a hearing over the preliminary restraining order.
Yes.
I was not able to get into the Zoom meeting. Apparently, it filled up very quickly, and it was Yom Kippur, and I wasn't rushing to get in. I'm just reading the court filings as they pop out.
You were fasting.
I was fasting. But it sounds like it didn't go terribly great for Epic.
Flat circle.
I put Apple in the show notes, but it actually didn't sound like it went great for Epic.
So, we'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll have to see. You know, I expect that we're going to start seeing, you know, it's going to be a little bit, could be next week that we'll see something from Judge Gonzalez-Rogers, but we'll see.
We'll have to see.
But the big thing that's happened is both sides have agreed for the very first time ever on this anyway, that they are not going to go to a jury trial. Now, the judge was pushing them away from a jury trial anyway because it makes more sense because there are counterclaims to just try everything, like hear everything at once.
Yeah.
And if it's done in front of a jury, they actually have to split that up. So, yeah,
that makes sense. I mean, if you're going to, and also if you're going to do it in front of a tax savvy judge.
Yes.
Seriously.
Yep. So a judge, and I don't know if it's going to be Judge Gonzalez-Rogers or a different judge.
Well, here's hoping that it is Judge Gonzalez-Rogers because she seems to know what's what. And she seems to know, like, she's on the up and up of tech. And it's sometimes, like we were just talking about, right, before we hit the break, is technology is often ahead of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes the same for judges. Judges aren't necessarily on the up and up of what's going on in technology, which means that they can sometimes issue judgments that may not make a ton of sense.
Yeah, she seems exceptionally savvy, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So they are going. So yeah, the outcome of this will be a trial by the court, not a trial by jury.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what happens. I don't know what Epic does if the temporary or the preliminary injunction doesn't fly. If she turns around and says, not only is Apple entirely permitted to ban Fortnite until you remedy the situation, but they can ban your other account too, and all of your Unreal stuff is done.
I think Epic has
to throw in the towel at that
point. They would have to crumble because that would go against all of their values, and quite frankly, I don't think Tim would stand for it.
Yeah, I think it would be really rough. But that is not our big story this episode.
Shockingly enough, it is not an Epic versus Apple episode.
In fact, since we told you, as is our new way, what the show title is at the start, you know, we're going to be talking about Crunch, and this was prompted by CD Projekt Red.
So we already knew that there were problems with Crunch at CD Projekt Red.
Yeah. Like Witcher 3 development was apparently a nightmare.
Rough. It was so bad and people were worked to the bone. But we were also told that because of all of the stuff that had come out, and this happened last year, last June, in fact, when news came out about CDPR's work culture, which was, you know, it was oppressive and continuous mandatory crunch, you know, leadership did promise that Cyberpunk would be free of mandatory crunch.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I mean, I was on board, which is part of the reason why when we went to E3 in 2019 and I saw Cyberpunk again, I was so excited. I was like, yes, this is what I'm looking for. This is the CDPR I want to see. I want to see better culture. I want to see something that's more inclusive. And here we go. We're finally going to get that game. Hey, Mike, do you think that we're going to get that game?
Oh boy. So let's be clear. There are a lot of issues with Cyberpunk right now.
Even though I'm still going to play it because, well,
just to be clear, for Amanda's birthday, we all, you know, pooled our funds and we got her. It was, we had to buy it secondhand. We paid a scalper a little bit extra. We got her the Cyberpunk Xbox One X.
Yes.
And that has, like, it's part of, like, it's redeemed. Like, yes. We can't not spend that money now.
Yeah, it's true. And I don't think that anyone else in the household is probably going to get it. Yeah. We'll have to see. Cyberpunk as a genre is supposed to be incredibly inclusive, and it's about exploring transhumanism and all of the things that are involved with a dystopian future where corporations have taken over and people have to band together in order to, you know, revolt and to rise up.
And, you know, there have been a number of problems with it, and we'll dive into the crunch in just a second, but just to refresh, there was some really transphobic comments that came out on the official Twitter account.
Yep.
And I don't know if you caught the Last Night City Wire, which is their video series. The gangs, they introduced a variety of the gangs.
Which is normal within within the cyberpunk genre. Again, the cyberpunk genre is heavily influenced by street culture in general. Mm-hmm. So when you see things like gangs, we can talk about this from the perspective of even Shadowrun. Shadowrun has gangs, sure, right? Absolutely. Like,
gangers are a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. They are something that exists. These gangs are extremely racist.
They are racial caricatures. There was the black gang. There was the Asian mashup gang.
Yeah. It was a nightmare. And it's really distressing because it's hurting a lot of people that are like, this is the game I want to play. This is the game I'm most excited for. And why are you giving me caricatures? And why aren't you exploring cyberpunk as the genre it was supposed to be? So on top of that, we also have the story that broke on Bloomberg.
Yes.
So Bloomberg broke news earlier this week that CDPR was going back on its word. It's going back on its word for not imposing mandatory crunch. The studio has instituted mandatory 6-day weeks. As somebody who used to work 6-day weeks as a software developer, that's trash. Staff has been reportedly working nights and weekends for a year. Yes. They lasted almost no time.
Yeah.
So Cyberpunk has been delayed twice.
Yeah. It's been in development, or I think it was announced. How many years ago was it announced?
Like 3 years ago, I think.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Like, I mean, I think they announced it, I think 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. Because I saw it, we both saw it in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I saw it in 2019. Mm-hmm. So prior to that, we knew it was coming, but we hadn't seen anything yet. So it has been delayed twice. First from April 2020 to September, mm-hmm. and then again from September to November.
Yep. So the Bloomberg story was pretty much, they had received some communications, some internal communications sent to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there was a response from CD Projekt Red studio head Adam Badowski on Twitter. Quote, "These last 6 weeks are our final sprint on a project we've all spent much of our lives on, something we care for deeply. The majority of the team understands that push, especially in light of the fact that we've just sent the game to CERT, and every day brings us visibly closer to shipping a game we want to be proud of. This is one of the hardest decisions I've had to make, but everyone is well compensated for every extra hour they put in. And like in recent years, 10% of the annual profit our company generates in 2020 will be split directly among the team." So there are two things that are happening here that are not common of companies that are crunching. Sure. One is they are claiming that all of these additional hours are compensated.
Which they are not in the United States.
Yep.
So that is probably true. Yes. Because labor laws outside of the United States mm-hmm. are not crazy.
And there was somebody who dropped into my mentions, and I don't know enough about Polish law to affirm or deny, but someone who dropped in my mentions to say, like, hey, just so you're aware, Polish law caps work weeks at 48 hours.
Yes, and it's very similar in Canada and in the UK, and I think most other places in the Commonwealth.
Yep.
So it's basically just you guys. Yeah.
Well, and we're backwards on a lot of stuff. A
little bit.
And the fact that they have a revenue share program.
That they talk about. Because even if companies do have revenue share programs within the United States, they don't talk about it. They're not transparent. So you got to give them props at least for that tiny little portion.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think we want to approach this fairly. And this is our jumping off point to have a conversation about crunch. Now, when I was writing the Game Dev Business Handbook, Alexander...
GameDevBizBook.com.
GameDevBizBook.com. Alexander and I had a conversation and we talked about we both emotionally wanted to include a chapter on crunch in the book.
Yes.
And we weren't sure, A, if we could pull it together in a way that was useful, mm-hmm. Beyond saying crunch is...
Crunch bad.
Crunch bad. Crunch is a symptom of bad planning.
Right. And it is.
And it is.
Both of these things can be true.
Yes. And if we were able to do it in a way that was fair. So we approached it like we did literally everything else for the book, and we interviewed experts.
Yes.
So for the book, I talked to Brenda Romero, and I talked to Ron Gilbert, mm-hmm. and I also got in touch with the author of the original EA spouse open letter.
Oh, that...
If you remember that.
Okay, so that one is a little esoteric if you haven't been in the industry for as long as we've been in the industry.
I would say we can credit EA Spouse, and hold on, because I want to pull up her name. I can't remember her name off the top of my head. And she eventually revealed herself. So I'm pulling out the book right now. Amanda's holding my iPad right here. It is the last chapter in the book.
It's a really good chapter. Honestly, like, we don't normally talk about Mike's book all that often, but the work that Mike put into this book with all of the various interviews and stuff, if you are curious about what it takes to run a studio, not to make games, but to run an actual studio, go and read the Game Dev Business Handbook. It really is. It's a fascinating read, and it's well written, and it's very approachable.
Why, thank you. So Aaron Hoffman wrote this.
Because, no relation.
No relation. wrote this anonymously. And in the blog post, and I got in touch with her, I said, hey, I'd like to include this. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that you, A, are aware of it, and B, you're cool with it. And she was. So here is how she described Crunch. I'm not going to read the whole letter, but I'll read the first graph. Within weeks, production had accelerated into a mild crunch, 8 hours, 6 days a week, which is what CD Projekt Red is doing now for Cyberpunk, assuming that they stick to the 8 hours.
Correct.
Not bad. Months remained until any real crunch would start, and the team was told that this, quote, pre-crunch was to prevent a big crunch toward the end. At this point, any other need for a crunch seemed unlikely, as the project was dead on schedule. I don't know how many of the developers bought EA's explanation for the extended hours. We were new and naive, so we did. The producers even set a deadline. They gave a specific date for the end of the crunch, which was still months away from the title shipping date, so it seemed safe. That date came and went. And went. And went. When the next news came, it was not about a reprieve, it was another acceleration. 12 hours, 6 days a week, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Oh my gosh.
So when we talk about crunch, I think it's important, and Aaron's paragraph there does point out the importance of understanding that not all crunch is created equal.
Correct.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit. In fact, yeah, we'll talk about it more extensively, but when I talked to Brenda Romero for the book, she talked about, I don't know if she used this term, but crunch sprints. And that is that very defined, we're going to do this for 2 weeks because we're crunching towards a milestone. And then we let back up.
Yes.
And we move back into a normal schedule. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not doing that, if you're just crunching and crunching and crunching, you're hurting people. And you're hurting the project.
Yeah, absolutely. And people. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, crunch is not specific to game development. This is everywhere. It's especially prevalent in tech and in software development. Again, speaking from experience, where I worked 6 days a week, 10 hours a day for not very long because I couldn't tolerate it and I didn't like my job. And I was like, all right, I'm going back to school because I don't want this to be my life. That aside, I mean, it's not productive. It is a diminished amount of work that people are going to be able to get done after a certain point in a day or after a certain number of hours in a day. And everyone is different. Everyone's rhythms are different. The way that people approach work is very different, which is why working from home has been kind of an eye-opener for a lot of studios where they're like, wow, our people have been more productive sometimes in the off hours than they are on the on hours, especially if they're parents. Mm-hmm. But they have been more productive working at home because they're able to work at their own pace without much in the way of distraction.
Yep. Now, there's a flip side to the crunch sprint.
Sure.
And that is planned crunch.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about planned crunch, because planned crunch, from my perspective, is a failure to have the resources available to avoid crunch in long spurts.
It is. It's bad planning.
It is extremely bad planning.
If when you are sitting down, you're working out your budget and your timeline, and your answer is, well, we know we're going to crunch for the last 3 months of development, ooh, you failed as a project manager.
Absolutely. You should not be baking crunch into your timelines. You need to be putting in at least 10 to 15% of your timeline for, you know, just extra stuff that ends up happening, if not more. I've seen project managers that will end up padding the project by an additional 15 to 20%,
yep,
depending on how large the project is and what the scope of the project is, as well as the budget.
And on the budget side of things, in the book, we recommend that you look at your budget.
Yeah.
You give it a good old try. And then add 20 to 25%.
Absolutely.
Because your costs are going to go over. You're going to go over time. You're going to go over budget.
100% of the time. It's like, it's almost not avoidable, especially in creative pursuits. You are not going to be able to meet your deadlines unless you are incisive about the way that you are spending your time, the way you are planning your time, and the way that you are spending your money. The only studio I know of in the industry that hits every single milestone without fail is Certain Affinity.
Oh, yeah.
They are the only one that I have heard of that has never slipped a deadline, that has never slipped in the way that they handle their budgets. They are very slow to hire. You know, that's the way that they manage their studio, because they are both a work for hire and an original IP studio, freshly original IP. Mm-hmm. But still, this is all stuff that you have to consider. And if you want the reputation for your studio to be, we plan crunch, you're on the wrong side of history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Crunch is nuanced.
Yes.
That's really what this comes down to. And the vast majority of our developer friends that we know and have been friends with a number for a number of years have all said that crunch is not inherently terrible. Sustained crunch is.
Yeah. And when it becomes abusive. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to point out. You said that if you are incisive, if you are, right on your deadlines, that doesn't actually factor in the one thing that you can't control. Literally everything else.
It's true. When I'm talking about the you, I'm talking about the project managers.
Got it. Okay.
I'm not, and the producer. So if we're looking at this from a top down perspective, the people that are doing the actual doing, they're going to do. They're mm-hmm. passionate people. They want to do well. They want to make good work. I'm not worried about them. I'm more worried about when it comes to the management process, when we're taking a look at the initial planning. And if you are building crunch into your plan, you don't need to do that. You just need to be incisive, and you need to make sure that you are following up at every single point where you need to, and making sure you have it baked into your timeline. I need to follow up here. I need to follow up here. I need to follow up here. I used to be a project manager, y'all. I was, like an operating officer of the chief variety, but that was many years ago. So
it's just remember, like, there are so many things like that are out of your control. You're an engine update, a tools update that suddenly breaks something.
Absolutely, which is why we're seeing more and more studios that can create their own tools. And there has to be time baked into the R&D process to build your own tools.
Remember when Hello Games had their office flooded?
Acts of God.
Acts of God. And, you can't control
gestures that. Broadly 20, to the
2020.
World.
You can't control 2020. 2020 cannot be contained.
It literally is like a seventh grader that has an attitude problem.
It always was, and it always will be again, 2020.
Oh, that's terrible. So that's the incisive thing was really just about the planning process and making sure that you are being proactive and executing on the plan instead of just being like, oh, I'm sure this person will get it done. They probably will. But if they're creatives, you just got to give them a nudge in the right direction mm-hmm. and make sure they're doing the thing.
So let's talk about the fallacy of productive crunch.
Oh my gosh, please, can we talk about this?
Absolutely. So take this, mental health charity. Among their wonderful works, the AFK rooms, all of the awareness that they brought to mental health issues in the gaming community.
I was part of the Take This Mental Health Awards in games.
You were.
Which was really fun.
They wrote a white paper a couple years ago.
Yes.
And
it's an incredible white paper.
It is. So in that white paper, crunching employees suffer decreased cognition below what would be experienced during a normal 35 to 40 hour work week. So what happens is the more you work,
the less effective you are.
The less effective you are, and you could actually be detrimental. So what we end up talking about is, well, if somebody is that tired, they're making mistakes. They're introducing new and more bugs into the software.
Or they're introducing problems. Like, we're not just talking about this from a coding perspective. We can also be looking at this from even things like sound design, looking mm-hmm. at this from animation, from rigging, any of the different things that go into making a video game, lots of things that we don't mention here, but every discipline will suffer from this. And it doesn't matter what you do. You are an integral part in building a game. And if you are overworked and you cannot function and you cannot think, you are going to make mistakes and create more work for yourself and for your team and therefore for the game in the very near future.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So not only that, crunch leads to burnout, which leads to turnover.
Yes.
And hiring costs are about 21% of an annual salary, according to the Center for American Progress. So what that does is you are introducing more money issues into your budget, mm-hmm. which is going to be constrained by that point. And the burnout of one person creates a domino effect as others have to end up picking up the slack. So even if you introduce another mythical man hour into your project, you're still going to end up having to play catch up because there are critical things that need to happen in order to move on to the next thing. it's not like it's a waterfall where you're constantly like, this is dependent on this is dependent on this is dependent. Like, everybody works in Agile. Yep. Like, that's just the way it works.
So, along those lines, the Games Outcome Project in 2015, it's a survey of a variety of developers. They actually talked a little bit about the difference between voluntary crunch and involuntary crunch. Now,
when we'll get into that because there's there. Yeah, we'll get into that.
So note that despite whether it's voluntary or involuntary, you're, if you're working more hours, again, that lower productivity per hour factor comes in.
Yeah.
People tend to be more unhappy.
Which, if you're unhappy in a project, that's also contagious. That it is. Lack of morale is going to go from person to person to person, which is going to decrease productivity even more because happy people do more work.
Yes.
And do better work.
Exhaustion, depression, burnout, all of that stuff leads to lower critical thinking as well. Absolutely. So you're not finding creative solutions or you don't have the energy to problem solve.
Because you're so tired. And so you just end up doing, you end up doing the work, but it's worse.
Yep.
Which?
And then you have problems. Remember we talk about bugs. We talk about the work not being good enough. Miss milestones or have rejected milestones, that leads to delays. So there have been a number of instances where if you crunch too much especially, it leads to a delay, and then you're in a situation where you're behind on time, you're behind on budget, and what happens? More crunch!
Which leads to more delays, which yes. is exactly what we've seen with CDPR. They've delayed the game twice, and while they are not major delays, it's enough.
Yep.
And again, we do need to talk about the difference or the not difference, quite frankly, between voluntary and involuntary labor. In theory, voluntary crunch has a different or at least slightly less severe impact than involuntary crunch, but it doesn't.
The issue is whether it's truly voluntary. Now remember,
that's the thing.
There is involuntary crunch. You will be here in your seat 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day.
12 hours a day.
And then there is the involuntary crunches where I'm working on this one task and I really want to get it done. Versus the corporate culture is...
There. That's the thing.
The executives stay late. Our creative director stays late. Our game director stays late. Our game director is in seat. And there is an expectation set from the top that you model the behavior of the leaders.
Absolutely. And that is something that we have ingested through all of our years with interacting with capitalism in any form, is that leadership is going to show us what to do and how to do it. And we need to follow everybody else's lead. If you are leading with crunch, regardless of whether or not it is something that you expect from your people or not, your people are going to emulate your behavior.
It's the difference. It's the implicit work culture versus the explicit work culture.
Absolutely. And the implicit thing that is happening here is, hey, look, I'm not asking you to do this. You know, you do you, but I've got a lot of work I need to catch up on because of, you know, whatever reason. So I'm going to be staying late. And then you think to yourself, especially if you're young, especially if mm-hmm. you're new, especially if you have something to prove, especially if you're marginalized in any way, shape, or form.
I don't want to be laid off. I want to make sure that I'm here to work on the next project. I want people to say good things about me. I want my career to flourish.
I want my career to flourish. That one's the big one. Once this project is said and done, can I look back on this and know that I still have a job, that I still have people that are going to speak highly of me? Did I ship a product that I feel really happy about, knowing that I did just as much as everybody else? When you measure yourself, when the same measuring stick is used for everybody, but it's like, we're not telling you what to do. But in order to succeed and in order to move up in the company from your junior role to a senior role.
We've got to see you give it your all.
We're a family.
Yeah. Oh, that family nonsense. It's manipulative.
It's very, very bad.
So...
Here's the big thing, though. There is a fallacy out there that only troubled games need crunch.
And that's not true. In fact, I have no doubt that Cyberpunk is going to do exceptionally well. I have no doubt. Remember, it's going into cert now. So what they're working on between now, assuming it passes cert, is day one
patch. It's a day one patch, yes.
So it's 6 weeks of polishing. So
But that's
should we talk about MVPs at this point?
the minimum viable product?
Yes.
Certainly we can talk about MVPs. So MVPs are the minimum viable product that needs to go to certification so that you have a game that is mostly finished, that is mostly ready.
So your achievements are... Now, when we talk about this, so CERT, FQA, Lot Check are the three names.
Yes.
FQA is Sony, CERT is Microsoft, and Lot Check is Nintendo.
Yes.
So if you go through any of those...
Or all of them.
Or yeah. So you're going through a process. And what that includes is things like, do you have the right button prompts? So for instance, if you send it over to Microsoft and you've got a circle, a square, a triangle, and a cross, and not an A, B, X, Y, you're going to fail CERT.
Yes, you will 100% fail CERT.
If your achievements don't work, you're going to fail CERT.
You are going to fail CERT.
And there's a bunch of stuff. If you don't integrate well with the system functions,
yeah,
you know, there's a huge checklist that you have to go through. And you miss any one of those, you fail CERT. And then you got to go back through the whole process again.
It is a daunting, daunting process. And it takes weeks to get through. It doesn't take months, but for large projects,
especially this time of year during the fall rush.
That's right, during the fall rush, it is extremely important that you dot all your I's and cross all your T's and have all of your ducks in a row.
Yes.
So, and have them quacking.
So there's this idea that if you're crunching, it's because the game is bad. Now, I think maybe we've moved away from that a little bit since crunch has been more of a topic around more games, and we understand, like, hey, these are good games and they're crunching.
Yes, or these are great studios with what I thought was a culture that would probably defy crunch, still end up crunching.
I mean, let's talk about Naughty Dog. Naughty Dog has been under fire for its crunch culture.
And Naughty Dog was built on crunch culture, unfortunately. But again, we're also talking about very old school studios. Let's talk about indies.
Yeah.
So indies still suffer from crunch. They do. And it isn't because indies are sucky or because they have crappy teams or because they have crappy management. It all comes down to everyone that works on these projects are very passionate. They're so excited. They want to give it their all. They want to do their best work. They want to create a game, an experience, whatever, that people are going to love and they're going to fall in love with and they're going to want to come back to over and over again. And a lot of them don't necessarily have the experience, or they don't have the resources, or they just maybe underestimate the timeline or the budget or whatever. And they end up in this place where they feel like they have to crunch in order to make their next milestone so they don't run out of money, so that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That is why when Epic Games came in and started bringing on the EGS exclusives, and they were able to give developers, you know, a significant amount of money for guaranteed minimums on their system, on their platform. It's not really a platform, on their storefront.
Yeah, storefront.
So on their storefront, what it did, especially for like studios like that made Ooblets, that was a big one.
And they were very, very vocal and very transparent about that.
Absolutely. And they've been working on Ooblets for a long time. The only reason why they were able to actually finish it in a reasonable amount of time, and the game's not finished, it's in early access, but they were still able to make the right decisions that were right for their studio and right for their team. Right? And they were able to do that because they had the money to do it. So it isn't about troubled games or troubled studios. Every game project is going to have to deal with, do we crunch or not crunch? What's our budget like? How do we make sure our people get paid?
Absolutely. So one other point, and this is in the book, Jennifer Hazel of the mental health organization Checkpoint noted in a GDC talk that 2 weeks of crunch is about all that people can handle before we start to see those serious impacts on emotional and mental well-being.
So a crunch sprint. We are focused. This is what we need to do to hit this next milestone to make sure that we unlock funds from our publisher.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we make sure that our investors are, you know, keeping up with us or whatever. This is what we're working towards. It's 2 weeks. That's it. And then we're done. Yep. So Brenda's response to crunch.
Exactly. And remember, I just said emotional and mental, but there are also physical impacts. There's physical impacts of burnout. You've been burnt out. I've been burnt out.
I was burnt out like around this time last year, in fact. Yeah.
And burnout feels bad, man.
Yeah, it really does. Like for me, what burnout feels like in my body is like I'm always anxious. So it's like my heart is constantly racing. I get stomach aches all the time. I get headaches all the time.
It takes so much effort. Fatigue. It takes so much effort to start to do something.
It does, because you're just like, oh my God, if I get pulled off this thing, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yep. So let's talk about some of the factors that lead to crunch in addition to bad planning.
Absolutely. Well, not just bad planning, but, you know, potentially limitations on resources if we're talking about it from an indie perspective. Or overscoping
a project.
Or overscoping a project and not necessarily knowing where to prune or, you know, again, it comes down to experience and resources. If you don't have the right people in the right roles, how are you supposed to know?
Yep. One of the other things we talk about in the Game Dev Business Handbook, that's gamedevbizbook.com. While we've done more plugs in this show than the entirety of the other 47.80th episode
bites us again.
So we talk about what it's like to delay a game.
Yes.
It's actually easier, is becoming easier to move a release date. And the reason for that is as digital becomes more prominent, you have less investment in retail. Now, when I talk about investment in retail, we're talking about huge marketing spends at point of purchase.
Yes. So making sure that you are equipping your retailers with things like signage, with the physical product itself, potentially with marketing promotions that give them deals, you know, any number of things.
Exactly. And reprinting all that collateral, communicating a change in release date. Again, when you're releasing mostly digitally, oh, hey, we slipped a week.
Nah. It's really not the end of the world. It's not a big deal. Okay.
You just move it in Steam, right? You just move the release date in Steam and EGS and you're good to go in the storefront. I mean, if you're done with cert at that point, remember it's the day one patches.
Yeah.
Or you're still going through cert. It's like, okay, well, we think we're going to be another couple days. We can't release as quite as early. It's a little bit easier to move that release date.
Yes.
The other thing is public companies versus private companies.
This one's the tough one, right? Yeah. Because, you know, you and I have had a lot of these conversations over the years, some of them on Virtual Economy and some of them not, where shareholders in public companies want like more and more and more and more and more profit.
We have talked about this quite extensively.
So with the dedication to bringing in more profit for shareholders hate slipped deadlines.
Yep.
And they lose confidence in leadership if it turns out, and potentially stock prices can take a nosedive if there are major problems with release dates. And it creates a whole, it's like that is the that is another domino effect that happens because the stock takes a dip. Execs end up, the C-suite panics.
Yeah,
panic all the way
down. The dominoes of anxiety.
Yes. The infinite scream loop.
Yeah, exactly.
Where everybody's screaming at each other because everything's bad.
Yeah, in private companies where they don't have to report, they can report to shareholders and they can actually, very easily give them more information.
Absolutely, because it doesn't need to be on the public record.
Exactly. So those are two considerations.
Honestly, before we do that, I just had a quick thought about Bethesda. It'll be really interesting to see how that ends up affecting Bethesda.
I actually just had that exact same thought.
Because you and I have been thinking about Bethesda's financials for like a decade.
Yes, and have been wondering. And now we have a little bit of an idea, and we talked about that on the last episode, and kind of valuations and all that stuff.
It'll be really interesting.
That $7.5 billion.
That's a lot of bells.
It's
a lot of bells. Tom Nook is rolling in it.
Yes. Okay, we talked about implicit versus explicit work culture. And so when we talk about different kinds of crunch, right, compensation matters. We talked about this early on. And whether or not, if you as an executive say, all right, we're crunching, but we're going to compensate people.
How are you compensating them, though?
With cash.
That's not necessarily the case.
Okay, but here's the thing. In the case of CD Projekt Red, they did say that, I hope that it's not like, hey, we're giving you more meals because...
No. So how it worked for me, let me give you some of my, some of what happened to me when I worked in software. And this was in British Columbia and Canada, so it's very different. And it was also like, oh my God, how many years ago was that? 13 years ago. Oh my gosh. That was many years ago. So, no, 12 years ago. So anyway, I really can't believe it's been that long since I've been like a real software developer. That's really strange.
Now you're just a real podcaster. Now I'm just... streamer. And
Ready Player Mama.
And consultant.
And I don't even know what's happening anymore. Anyway, point being is that when we were told, hey, look, we need to crunch. We need to do the thing. You need to work extra hours. We are going to give you extra time off. You can bank this time to use it for time off. And so my husband and I, and we weren't married yet. We were engaged. We looked at each other and we're like, how's that going to help if we're gone? Are they just going to pay out our vacation hours? Because like, this isn't helping us in any way, shape, or form now. Like, I was having migraines, and, like, I was burnt out, and everything was really bad. I had bad stomach aches. sorry, all from all of this. So the compensation there was your banking hours. That's not necessarily cash.
Well, I hope that when CDPR says that their employees are well compensated for every extra hour, that it's financial, tangible, direct compensation.
I really, really hope so. But if they're anything like any of the Canadian tech companies I've ever worked with, everybody does banked time.
So flipping the script, if you are not compensating through direct payment to these employees for crunching, then executives have no incentive to improve. There is no
None.
Pinch at the top. They are only squeezing people at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And they will keep doing it because they get away with it. As long as their project comes in on time, then they smell like roses. And
oh, they can go to the shareholders, regardless of whether or not you're private or public, and say, look what we did.
Yep.
Look at the miracles we worked.
So I want to have a quick conversation. Why does crunch happen at the end? And why is it so hard to avoid? Why do even some really great studios that don't have a ton of crunch tend to crunch either right up against milestones or at the end of a project?
So there are a number of reasons why crunch tends to happen towards the end of a phase or heading towards the next milestone or whatever. And when it in the lead up to certification and launch, it's normally because things that you did not realize needed to happen, you have to put on your to-do list. So you look at the scope of a project, and as a project manager or a producer, you're like, all right, here is the lay of the land as I know it today. I can see all of the mountains, I can see the trees, I can see the little villages, I can see my map. It looks good. I think I can understand pretty much everything that needs to get done that I need to do to convert this into what I want it to be. But then you forget about that tree off in the distance somewhere, and you're like, uh-oh, that's going to be a real problem later if I need to get out into that. Okay. And then you get to that tree, and you're like, oh God, I forgot about the tree.
Ha!
And no, I'm serious. Like, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I didn't actually map this thing. Oh gosh, that's awful. Oh no, we need to do this now. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We got to get into a crunch sprint. I know it sucks, but this is something that we didn't realize we needed to do. Or maybe something slipped a little bit here and there. And they were little slips, tiny slips. Slips that you wouldn't think that would create this domino effect, but they always do.
Yep. There is another aspect of the interesting timing around when crunch tends to happen, even in studios that manage crunch really well. It's that you hit a point in a project where the question becomes, well, why not just bring on more people if you have more work to do? And you get to the point, either right up against a milestone or at the end of a project, when it becomes impossible to onboard new people because the amount of time it would take to bring them up to speed.
The mythical man hour.
Yep. And you get to this point and it's like, well, if we spend the time to train somebody else up, that is also going to put us back.
Yes.
So you run into a situation where the only answer is crunch because we can't add more people at this point.
Well, regardless.
And we can't get it done by the deadline, so our choices yes. then are delay, mm-hmm. which we have already done X number of times, or crunch. And when you have retail involved, when you have shareholders involved, each one of those becomes a consideration, and you look at your stakeholders.
Or if you have that, the stakeholders, that is the key, because it could still be a problem in indie companies that are quite small.
Yes.
So that could be Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Right?
Could be Kickstarter. It could be
Patreon.
It could be your investors. Just your general investors are, hey, we were expecting to have some kind of return by X, and you're telling me the project is now going to take X plus 6 months?
X plus 12? Yeah.
You know, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the two big factors about why it tends to happen at those points in development, as was told to me by people who are much smarter about this.
So the TLDR is, oops, I forgot a thing, and I didn't realize that we needed to do the thing, or I thought the thing was done, or whatever. Any kind of oversight that tends to happen, and you're like, oh crap, that slipped. Something slipped somewhere, and there were tiny slips everywhere, and then everything turns into this massive kerfuffle. That is one thing. The other thing is the mythical man hour of, oh, I can't actually add an extra body now. Now I have to just crunch my remaining people.
Yep. So the last thing I want to circle back on, because this has been a very business-focused conversation, is when these things become apparent to the audience, why is it that most, I don't want to say all, because I think that we are building awareness
yes.
amongst, and this is where we have the conversation about ethical consumption and all of that stuff, right?
Which we've already had when we talked about Joanne's bullshit.
Yes, and we didn't even cover the reported statements out of WB.
I don't want to talk about it.
So, you know, most consumers, if you look at the broad body of people who you know about it, and we're not even talking about the people who are not plugged in. They say, hey, I see this game. I'm interested in this game. They're not plugged in. They're not extremely online.
Exactly. They don't necessarily know the context around the development of the game, which honestly is the vast majority of consumers anyway.
Yep. So the question then becomes, why won't consumers mobilize when we find out that a studio has gone back on its word about crunch, or another studio has been revealed to have excessively toxic work environments?
For the same reason why politicians end up in power, even though they're not good people, they don't care.
Yeah, people don't care. And I don't think that this is, again, I'm not painting everybody with this brush. In fact, the discourse around this, there has been a lot. Now, of course, we follow a lot of developers, yes, and we follow a lot of people who understand the industry, and people who know, and I think this is a big piece, who know developers. Like, if you know developers, like,
if you know and love a developer, you definitely do not want your developer to have to crunch.
Yes. But for a lot of people, it doesn't directly affect them.
It's just like potentially problematic environments in film. We have a friend of ours who is a camera operator in Vancouver, and you know, he has told me some horror stories about some of the shows that he's worked on. I will not watch those shows now, even though I really care about, you know, potentially the IP or the or whatever. I'm just like, no, I'm not going to touch that. If that is honestly the way you're being treated, that's dumb. I'm not supporting that. But that's for me. I am one person.
Right. So I guess my call to those of you who are listening who are consumers,
which is basically all of us. Like, let's be real.
But not expressly people who work in the industry. But if you're just,
if you are an industry enthusiast, yes, versus someone who is actively working in the industry, we want you to consider how you support or don't support the various studios that talk about crunch, that engage in crunch, that work in ethical versus unethical capacities, et cetera.
Yep. And again, everybody has to make that decision for themselves. But if you care about microtransactions, if you care about whether an annualized sports franchise earns its $60 or soon to be potentially $70 every year, if you care about those things because they affect you, I would just urge that the way games are made affects you. You probably just haven't thought about how yet. And that about wraps us up.
It really does. This has been episode
48.
48, I believe.
We are creeping up to 50.
We're technically going to be 50 next episode.
No, the 0th episode is disowned. I never want to talk about it again.
Oh, but I loved that episode.
Me too. Me too. I love you, 0th episode.
We really did shoot ourselves in the foot. And we warned each other. We're like, this is probably going to be bad in the long run. We're probably going to lose count. We're like, we're probably not going to be on this for that long. It's just a podcast. I mean, like, who's going to listen to us? So thank
more
you.
More of you. More of you. So thank you.
So thank you for listening to us, because honestly, we didn't think that we would have an audience.
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I'm at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I am at Amanda Farrow. If you don't know how to spell my last name, I'm going to spell it for the first time ever on Virtual Economy. It's FAROUGH.
And you can subscribe. If this is your first time listening to Virtual Economy, thank you for being here. Welcome to the family. Not like a company's a family. We're not asking you to crunch.
No, we're more like Resident Evil 7. Welcome to the family, son.
Okay. I'm Spoopy Mike Fuller. Thank you for listening to Virtual Economy.
Thank you so much for picking up on where I was going with that.
If this is your first time and you want to subscribe to our podcast, we would absolutely love that. You can add us to your RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn, that's libsyn.com/RSS, or you can subscribe on your favorite podcast delivery service, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, and there's one more.
Pocket Sand. The only place that we don't exist is iHeartRadio, and I am working on fixing that.
I broke iHeartRadio. Oh, I made that joke last time.
You've made it 4 times in a row.
That's 5 times. Please subscribe, and if you can, review the show. Let us know what you think. You can also, if you want to let us know what you think or you have a question, shoot us a DM at Virtual Econcast, or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
And we will be back next week. We actually have two shows next week.
Yeah, we're going to have... it's going to be interesting. I'm not sure, because we're recording an interview on Thursday.
Oh, we might not have two.
Yeah, so we might kick that to the next... That'll probably be up the week after. So we'll have a new show next week, and then the week after we'll have an interview. So I think that interview is technically going to be episode 50.
That's kind of awesome, actually.
Yeah, that's really good. I hope it's a good interview.
It's going to be a really cool interview. I'm really excited about it. I love talking to C-suite, especially when they have like a varied backstory /origin story.
It's someone from a company you know.
It is someone from a company.
They do very cool things.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. We'll see you soon.